Tereo Ererangi o Te Mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout. Marianne, I got to talk to poet Harry Ricketts face-to-face last week, which was a real joy.
Yeah, lovely.
Because we do most of our interviews over Zoom or phone, but to get somebody into the studio and talk to them is lovely, and especially a poet, and a poet as renowned as Harry, to have him here and listen to him read some poems and talk about his latest collection.
A little private performance, and
exactly.
You're revealing one of your prejudices there. Maureen thinks poets are the most interesting people. Well, I had a fascinating interview as well with Chris Blake, who has written, he's an ex-detective. Well, he is a detective, I think, who still works and is a crime writer. This is the first time he's written published under his own name, and the book is called Softly Calls the Devil. And it's there were lots of things in it which made you realise you were in the hands of somebody who knew what they were talking about. And it was a great read. So Chris Blake, Softly Calls the Devil. That's great.
Authenticity, very, very important. And somebody who is incredibly authentic, if you can be, if that's a proper phrase or term, is Elspeth Sands, who has written huge number of novels, short stories, plays, scripts. She has been around for a long time, which is not a euphemism. But she's very well known in New Zealand literary circles and has written wonderful work and, as I say, knows what she is writing about. And her latest novel is up there with her best. Elspeth Sands' life has provided her with plenty of material for her role as a renowned storyteller. She was adopted and brought up by a loving father but a cold and cruel mother, and she told stories to comfort herself. This led on to an acting career in the UK, three marriages, many award-winning novels, plays, short stories, two memoirs, and an account of a trip to China in search of the story of her famous cousin, Rewi Ali. A Gap in Nature is her latest novel. It's an intriguing tale spanning six decades and two countries. And I must say, it's a very satisfying read. So thank you, Elspeth, and welcome.
Thank you. I do like that word, satisfying.
Trying to find a word that was satisfactory for the feeling I had when I was reading the book, and then I realised that satisfying was it, because it's a very well-structured story. The pace is good, you know, the tension is there, and memorable characters.
Thank you. I read so many modern novels. I mean, I read avidly, so, and every so often I think something's happened to the novel. You know, it's kind of gone down a rabbit hole. So you don't have those satisfying moments where you feel there's some kind of resolution or some kind of understanding of a situation or characters. A lot of modern novels become more about the writing than about the storytelling. And I guess I'm basically a storyteller who believes in good writing and tries to write as best I can. But I think we do, a story is fundamental to ourselves as human beings.
We crave stories because we want to make sense of the world. And one of the ways of trying to do that is to go into the imaginary world and
Yes, well, it goes right back to sitting around the fireside after a day hunting bison, you know, telling the story of your day or making sense of your relationship with the bison. You know, I do think it's deeply fundamental, and I think it will never go away despite various fashions in novel writing. It won't go away.
Of course not. Of course not. A gap in nature. Now, that, you know, I can see where your inspiration for the story, well, one of your inspirations, shall we say.
Yeah. Well, the title comes from Antony and Cleopatra, and it's I've kind of inverted the meaning of those words, because it's Ina Barbus's speech as Cleopatra is going down the Nile looking absolutely stunning, and he describes her as looking so incredibly beautiful that she creates a gap in nature. In other words, the world stops breathing. So I sort of turned that round to make it represent when, in my case, a mother doesn't behave as nature says she should behave. So it becomes a gap in the natural order of things.
Yes.
So it's kind of play on it.
Yeah, and so the consequences form, you know,
yes,
what the novel's
the
about.
Story, that's
yeah,
the kick off the story, yes.
Now, you've set it initially in a place called Claytown, which is somewhere between Auckland and Wellington, and it's
no reflection on Tamaranui, which I happen to love because my half-brother farmed nearby in Tamaranui, so I became very fond of that little town. But it's that kind of much smaller, very tight-knit town, which, of course, the story begins just on the outbreak of World War II, where I think everybody knew everybody's business. So it was both a good thing and a bad thing, I think, that intimacy. Mm.
And into the town comes May Nichols, an English woman who's married the town's favourite son, as you call him, and proceeds to you know, alienate herself, but be alienated as well.
Yes, well, you gradually through the novel learn a bit of her backstory, but it's drip-fed really through the story until you get the revelation at the end. So there's a reason why she's the way she is. So although she comes across as an unsympathetic character in that early section of the book, I hope that there is a sort of understanding of her later on when her story is revealed.
Well,
at that time, I think an English woman with pretensions, she did have social pretensions despite having no basis for them whatsoever. She considered herself superior to the rather uncouth Kiwis she was surrounded by. So I think that's probably a story that you could repeat many times across New Zealand at that time, you know, when English people spoke differently were considered, they were still the mother nation. So
yeah, and we were the, as you say, uncouth colonials.
Yes,
There's some lovely portraits of people in the town, her relatives and so on. There's a lot of humour in there as well as, you know, making the characters very realistic. You're not stereotyping them necessarily, but there's humour there.
Mm, oh, good. Yes.
May and her beloved son David have, as you say, an unusual relationship. The way she chooses to bring him up kind of sets the scene for his later... Well, what could we say? I'm trying to think of a word that doesn't
Well,
that doesn't let the cat out of the bag for
the
what
bag.
Happens
no,
to him later.
Yeah, his life becomes a traffic accident, really, doesn't it? But he starts off as a golden boy, you know, and that's also another story with kind of mythical shapings to it of the golden boy who too much is expected of him. He expects too much of himself. He thinks life will be, will fall, things will fall into his lap because that's how he's been brought up. It's a terrible thing to do to a child, to bring them up and make them feel that they are so special that they don't really have to try.
Mm. So, David, the story goes, you know, jumps to him being in London, and it's a time when you would have been there and experienced what it was like to be in that world.
Yeah, a little bit before I got there, but because it was when I, by the time I went, television was very established, whereas he arrives as it's kind of inventing itself mostly. So he's there at the beginning of television, particularly television drama. So I did a lot of research around that because I wanted, even though it's not a big thing in the story, I felt it was important to pick up that excitement and the way everybody felt then, that it was kind of the death of family life and communication, just as we do now about AI. We've had these repeated fears of technology destroying our humanity. Well, that was quite strong at that time around television.
Of course. But your experiences as an actor over there inform the life of David's wife.
Yeah, it was very exciting. I mean, I'd love to live that period again, when you just felt that anything could happen. You particularly if you were in which I was briefly in repertory, you play you're playing Medea one day and a servant in a Shakespearean play the next week. You know, there was such a lot happening creatively. I'm really sad that creativity has, the arts have been so downsized since that time, because the arts was driving an awful lot of the politics that was all connected. You know, there was a lot of energy and the old Commonwealth empire was sort of coming, everybody was tipping up in England. So there were people like Salman Rushdie and from all over the Commonwealth, and there's so much creative energy. It was a wonderful time.
Yes, I actually went to see the documentary about Twiggy yesterday, and which was for nostalgic reasons as much as any, but it does capture how, I know it was later than when you've set David's arrival in London, but it still was a time where you felt things were being upset and new things were happening and people were questioning things, and it was young people were out there.
And they were being listened to. They were making way. And it felt, I mean, even though there's been a lot of writing since then to say that the 60s is the source of all our woes now, but in fact, it felt like a good time. It felt as if good things were happening, not bad things. I mean, I think bad things are happening now.
yes, there's plenty to depress you now. So harking back to that time, it does seem a little more innocent, doesn't it? And things felt possible.
Yes.
And things don't feel possible now. But we're getting away from your story because, of course, David the Golden Boy, things do not go right for him. We won't go into how things end for him. But then you jump forward again into the 1990s where his daughter is trying to unravel what shaped her father, the mystery around her grandmother, all those things, and tell us about that part.
Yes, I mean, I believe very strong. Well, I think there's plenty. I don't need to believe it. I think it's there. It's self-evident that family trauma does tend to go from generation to generation, and I wanted, in writing the novel, I wanted to ask myself the question, how do you break that? Whether the trauma is sexual or violence or financial, any kind of real trauma that interrupts and disturbs people in the family setting. And I couldn't find a universal answer. I just had to find the particular answer for this three generations of family, how they could break that the trauma going from one generation to the next. And, of course, often it's the trauma is hidden within secrets. And I've had, because I'm adopted, I think, and didn't know for many decades what my real background was, I have an absolute visceral hatred of secrets. I often think about, you know, secret services, you know, the way that men seem to love this thing of having secrets, but I think women are inclined to be more open and actually want to know what's hidden so that they can get on with the truth and live the truth. So that's what the story's about. It's about finding the secrets and the reasons why there were secrets and exploding them, hopefully.
Well, that harks back to why it's a satisfactory read, because the uncovering of the secrets, and I'm not giving a secret away now to say that it does bring about, you know, mightn't solve all problems, but it does bring about you know, a sense of understanding and
moving past
yeah. and yeah. the ability yes. to get on with one's life, not burdened by these secrets.
No. I mean, I hear so often people of my age saying, still talking about their difficult relationship with their mother or their father and so on, you know, and this is decades later, and you think, Shouldn't that have been sorted out by now? Shouldn't it have been resolved? And I do think it's important that we find way. I mean, I suppose therapy is one way, but as Graham Greene said, writing novels is the best therapy you could possibly have.
And reading them, I've always thought is the best therapy for people. Yeah, go in, find out how.
That there are people who've been through far worse than what you think you've been through or someone else has been through, you know, and they've survived and through art. Mm.
Indeed. And well, you know, you have done some extraordinary work for all of us who enjoy going to plays, reading short stories, reading fiction, long fiction, being challenged to examine ourselves in what we read. So, you know, thank you, Elspeth.
Thank you.
I don't want it to sound like, you know, this is the end of a long life of achievement.
Well, it'll come to an end at some point.
Well, unfortunately, that is the fate of all of us. But I think, you know, I can't imagine you ever not having a story to write.
No, I can't. I can't imagine being alive and not having a story to write. It's my happy place when I'm actually writing, not when I'm doing. Nicer just to talk to you, not when I'm doing this kind of thing, but when I'm just actually on my own with my computer.
Mm. Well, thank you, as I say, for another great novel. Well-written, intriguing, engrossing. The story is called A Gap in Nature. It's by Elspeth Sands and it's published by Quentin Wilson Publishing.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Softly Called the Devil is a brand new crime thriller from author and police detective Chris Blake. Chris has published before under a pseudonym to keep the fiction separate from the real crimes he works with on the daily, but his fiction debut, The Sound of Her Voice, was a finalist in 2018 Naomi Marsh Awards for both Best Novel and Best Debut. We're speaking to Chris just 2 days after his next novel hit the shelves under his own name. Tēnā koe, Chris. Thanks for joining us on Bookends.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Cool. So, does it feel really different, a book out under your own name?
It does. Frighteningly different.
Wow.
Yeah, definitely. I seeing my real name out there scares the hell out of me. And even worse, you know, seeing your photo in the paper as well. So that is all very foreign to me and very different from last time round.
Right. Does it feel more frightening because of your profession as a detective? Or is it just anyway that kind of exposure sensation as a writer being, you know, tying you so closely to your work?
Yeah, I think it's probably just my personality more than anything. I've got incredible lack of self-belief, and my wife's great at trying to point me in the right direction when I need it. So I think it's just fear. It's just fear that I've written a crap book and no one's going to like it, but everyone's going to like my name.
That's so funny because your previous one was so well received, but that was written by that other fella, was it?
Yeah, that was that other guy. Yeah.
Really interesting. It's not a crap book, by the way, readers and Chris. It's definitely not a crap book. Chris, just tell us, what was your pathway to becoming a detective in Aotearoa? And when in that journey did you know that you wanted to write as well?
Oh, yeah, good question. The journey to join the police was an odd one for me. I didn't grow up wanting to join the police. I wanted to be a pilot, like everybody else. And through high school, I sort of, around about that time, realised my eyesight wasn't going to cut it. So I never made it into the Air Force as a pilot, which was dream number one. I'm also horrible at maths and physics, so that might have been something to do with it. But I ended up joining the Army instead, just the reserves, which is a part-time version of it. Loved a whole lot about it, but realised I didn't really want to be wet, cold, tired and hungry for the rest of my career. So I was looking for something to do, and I actually gave a crack. We had a unit called the Counter-Terrorist Tactical Assault Group, mm-hmm. Which was sort of a domestic counter-terrorism role within the wider SAS unit. And a wrong time in my life. I was quite young. I was in a relationship at the time, didn't have my why sorted at all, and struggled through that and pulled myself off the selection course. So I came off that licking my wounds and went, oh, what am I going to do now? And I sort of saw the police recruiting poster and went, oh, well, let's just give that a crack then. So it wasn't a long-term plan, but I really fell in love with the police and everything behind it. And once you're in the police, you see there's so many different avenues you can go down that you can do with your career. So I then found the CIB and fell in love with that as well. And just being able to take the time working through cases as opposed to just going job to job to job and not being able to really finish any of them the way you'd like to. So long journey, but really not a planned one.
Sorry to interrupt, but they're working through cases, just listening to that. It makes it sound like they all managed to be worked through. I can imagine the crimes investigation, you know, that it gets hell of a frustration at times. It certainly got frustrating in this, you know, where it gets doughy and you can't really find where it's going. So that's interesting. But when in that process did you decide that you wanted to be a writer as well?
Never until about the point I was terrible at English at high school, so and read comic books mainly. But there was a guy I worked with in the CIB, a guy called Simon Wyatt, and he, really intelligent bloke, better detective than I ever could have been. And he wrote a book. So when he did that, that was great for me because I'd never really considered it. It was something probably, if I think back now, at the back of my mind, it might have been something I'd like to do one day. And I was never going to do it. And then Simon wrote this book and I went, oh, like, okay, maybe I should pick up my big boy pants and give it a crack. So then it took me a few years after that to sort of piece together what became The Sound of Her Voice. And then after that, I just sort of kept chipping away writing because by then I was enjoying it. but I didn't really know I was going to enjoy it until I started. And that's thanks to Simon doing
fabulous,
it
first. Fabulous. That's pretty inspiring to think that somebody who didn't love books and literature and English at school can find their path to produce work of this quality. So fantastic. Okay, got to say this. This colloquial Kiwi hard man voice, okay, there's with lots of drinking, taking the piss, men's junk references all over the place, is that still so ubiquitous that it works like a signifier of a no-bullshit person in Auckland and Haast alike? Like, it sounds authentic because I recognise it, so it's obviously a voice that I know. In the police force, is it the go-to for connecting?
Yeah, that's hard to say. I don't know if it's something developed to try and build that rapport and get more out of an interaction, or if it's just something that the people that do it just happen to do that naturally. I'm not quite sure which one of those it is. It's probably a mix of the two. But certainly everyone loves humour, you know, so the best way to get someone to like you is to like them first. And humour is a great bridger of that. So, yeah, I think definitely in the book, Matt does that a lot. Part of it is probably a coping mechanism, and part of it is, yeah, definitely a learned behaviour. If I say these things and I'm like this, life's going to be a bit easier. But I don't think it's an active thought process. It's just sort of a subconscious thing, yeah.
Okay. It's definitely not, listeners, a signal of misogyny or lack of erudition or kind of cultural nous, if you like, is it? Because there's a lot more to Matt than that hard case blokedom. It's his kind of comm style, but there's a lot more to him than that. And, you know, for that matter, some of the other characters from Haast that he's engaging with. But it did make me wonder whether you wanted that voice as a ticket to maybe finding a wider male readership, maybe people who weren't lovers of fiction generally but would feel comfortable with a character who was a bloke?
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of that, and probably also a little bit of just writing what you know. And being a bloke, I find it comfortable writing there. I would be very scared of writing sort of young adult fiction from a female perspective, because I'd feel I wouldn't be able to do that justice, right? And my wife will tell you that, you know, I should stay away from writing romance for exactly the same reasons. So it's probably no well more thought out than just that's who I
a natural kind of, a natural yeah. character for you to inhabit, yeah, totally. and a lovely guy. But it was just there's a very clear, distinctive voice there that was worth exploring a little bit. So, listeners, for men and women crime thriller junkies, this is a cracking good one. It's got old school gangs, not the new kind, old school cult power trips. Great setting for dark hoodoo business. It's got lots of twists and heart-racing action. There's a funny thing I noticed, though. It's not super heavy on the whole police procedural stuff, right? And it's treated quite lightly, but obviously with a really deep knowledge. So you kind of fade it more into the background, like just take it for granted. And it's quite cool when you read other crime writers. Does the procedural stuff like slap you in the face and you think, oh my God, you know, I'm a police officer and it's just not quite this like this? Like, tell me about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've gone through a journey in loving crime fiction and then hating it and then loving it again. And because early on when I started reading, and I started reading more crime fiction after I started writing, funnily enough, you know, I'd read those books and go, man, this twist at the end, they would have picked this up right on day one of the crime scene examination in real life, right? Yeah. And I had to get over that. And I actually now, I love the escapism of it and how fiction, you know, can tell a story in its own way. So with this, though, I still struggled with that heavy procedural aspect my first book was very procedural heavy, and there was, you know, the criticisms of it in to that regard, and I didn't want this one to be bogged down the same. And I think setting it in Haast helped with that, because it's a smaller community. Matt's the only cop there, so he doesn't have all these other wheels turning and all this other help going on. So a lot of it just comes down to him talking to people, which is probably how I was able to put all that procedural stuff a little bit more into the background, because it's very much about his conversations with people and that side of it.
Yeah, even when it's there and with the note-taking and, you know, and securing the scene and all those things, it's you fade it right into the background, and it just feels kind of like natural. This is what we do here, rather than this is what we need to talk about here. So congratulations on that. It's refreshing, and it's quite noticeably different. Also, Matt, bless him, he's not precisely a stickler for the rules. He's not gung-ho, okay, but evidence matters and all that stuff, waiting for backup, mostly. But there are moments when letting things play out just seems like the right thing to do, and he's more concerned with kind of being righteous and justice than he is with necessarily law. Is that a comfortable line for somebody who's in the police force to walk?
Not at all.
No.
So not at all. So I find myself writing, what would the police actually do here? And then I read it and I go, well, that's a boring read. And then I go, well, what would Matt Buchanan do here? And that's then the plot takes off. So it is uncomfortable for me. And I find it hard to go, I know this is what he should do here, but I've written this guy. This is who he is. This is what he believes in. This is where he's come from. The first book, very uncomfortable. He definitely does plenty of stuff in that book that no one should ever do. So I've pared it back, but still very much he is who he is. So he does have to step over those lines sometimes. Otherwise, he is just a wooden character on the wall that doesn't really impact the plot much. So,
okay, yeah, and so forgive me for not having done my research thoroughly, but I didn't read your earlier book. And so is this the same story, same detective, just your name on the cover this time around?
It's a different story. It's a sequel to the first.
Yeah, okay, so it is a sequel. Yeah.
But I've written it in a way where you don't have to read that one.
No, you definitely don't. I enjoyed this thoroughly without that. But I was going to ask because I assumed that the first one had a different detective and everything because it had a different author. So I was going to ask, are we going to get a prequel? So we've already had it. I just need to go and read it. That's good. Because Matt's backstory is really interesting. So if you listeners, feel free to read them in the right order, or like me, read them in the wrong order, because it works well either way. So Matt, are you going to stick Chris? This obviously a bit of you've got a very fluid identity, between the three of you. Chris, is Matt going to be back on? Are you working on another one with Matt? Or you've kind of got an idea for him, what he does next?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'd like to keep him in Haast for the next book. So I've started writing that. He's still there. He sort of uncovers a bit of an international drug smuggling ring, and it's going to involve the crayfish boats. That's where it's sort of going. But I'm very mindful. I don't want to turn this into a UK town TV series where all of the worst crimes in the world happen in this tiny little community. So I'm going to have to take him out of Haast at some stage and put him somewhere else. But no, definitely more stories on the way for sure.
Excellent. I'm pleased to hear it because he's very likeable, and as are the rest of the Haast community. I've read now three books set in Haast, three crime detective novels set in Haast. It's quite the setting, isn't it? So tell me about your time down there and how you've connected to that landscape and that community.
I love that first season of True Detective, with Woody Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey, and I loved how Louisiana was a character there, and the swamps and the bayous and the cane fields really set the scene. And I thought, I've got to come up with a place in New Zealand that's like that. And it wasn't until I was driving through Haast with my wife, we'd been in Wanaka, Queenstown, we're driving through back to Christchurch, and just coming through Haast and just going, wow, like this landscape is just incredible. The mountains, the trees look different. It looks like something out of Jurassic Park. The rivers, the swamps. And I just thought straight away, this is such a cool place to set a crime story. And then we went back and stayed there and looked around, and just the people are amazing. Everything about it is so cool. And I really hope I haven't put people off traveling to Haast with the story. But at the same time, I think, I don't know if everyone living in Haast would want a whole lot of influx of tourists either. So I hope I've run the right down the middle there, and right. I've done it justice without hopefully changing the game there for the people that live there all the time.
Yeah, no, I think the landscape certainly does feature large in the book, but there's room for more of it, and I'm glad to hear that the sea comes into our next chapter. So thanks so much for joining us, Chris. It's been a lovely interview. I hope you have terrific fun connecting with audience for Softy Calls the Devil, because I think there's a lot of people out there that are really going to enjoy it and enjoy meeting Chris, the man behind Matt. It's published by Echo Publishing. It's available at bookstores nationwide since Tuesday, the 4th of November. So great one for the stockings for Christmas and for the beaches over the summer.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Happiness. The movies that really hit the spot have ironic, downbeat, equivocal endings. Happiness's grand illusion is always just out of reach. Garance dwindles into the crowd. Rick turns from the Lisbon plane. Kane discards his tarnished star. Mosby adrift on point of view. Happiness seems a habit some gain early, some never, yet we cling to the thing with wings. A matter of collision, right place, right time, or not. It's no potato you can grow.
That was Harry Ricketts reading from his latest collection of poems entitled Bonfires on the Ice. Harry, of course, is a poet. He's a scholar, a biographer, a memoirist, and he's a beloved teacher of creative nonfiction and other literary matters. He's now retired from Te Heringa Waka Victoria University, but I think is still teaching at the International Institute of Modern Letters.
Yes, I teach this one course in the first half of the year, Crew 257, which is, as you say, is creative nonfiction. The creative is just to make it sound sexier, so it's nonfiction.
Well, I think it has become very sexy, with or without your trying. People love reading good nonfiction, Harry.
They do, yes. I mean, I guess if you were having over the last 20 years to 25 years to think of the genre or the kind of writing that's just kind of taken off into the stratosphere, it would be nonfiction. Essays, wonderful essays being written, terrific biographies, memoirs, autobiographies, you know, the whole kind of gamut. Yeah, there's been this amazing kind of mud rush of work.
Are we, or have we, required non-fiction writers to really, I'm resisting saying up the game. That's a terrible
expression. Well, there's always been terrific nonfiction writing. I mean,
yeah, but have we required them to use more fictional
Well, there are all sorts of kind of sections now. So there are, just as there are novels which are very, very close to autobiographies, so close that if you change the pronouns, you probably wouldn't see any difference. Similarly, with nonfiction, well, nonfiction uses lots of the same things as fiction. You know, you make choices all the time. Nonfiction often usually contains story, anecdotes, beginnings, endings, controlling metaphors, the rhythm of the prose. All of these things are very familiar from fiction, and the best non-fiction writers use them just as adroitly.
They do, they do. And we've strayed a long way from poetry, but...
We have, but that's all right. But also, poetry should be as well written as prose.
Yes, even better in some ways, because you have to make some very distinct choices, don't you, in how you
yeah.
place your words, how you choose your words, how you condense things down.
Yeah, and that probably happens, well, it depends. There are so many different ways that people do their poems, but from my point of view, yes, that's exactly what happens, that something appears on the page, something starts almost involuntarily, and then I start pursuing it and seeing where it's going to go. But at a certain point, editing comes in and trying to kind of see whether this is the shape that the poem's going to take, whether this is the kind of vocabulary it's going to have. You know, all of those more conscious activities come into play later on, I think.
I was going to ask you what precipitated a poem for you.
Well, normally I should be doing something else.
Ah, I see.
So I should
That's
be...
It's a diversion.
Yeah, so it's a sort of distraction and a diversion, and often a very welcome one. So I should be... Normally I should be doing some sort of prose thing, writing a review or... In the past, writing lectures when I was still teaching, and poems would kind of, as it were, interrupt me. But there are, of course, people who work very differently, and I quite understand that they do sit down at the desk in a much more, not 9-to-5 probably, but more routine kind of way. That's the space that they've got for the day. And may well sit down with a kind of an idea for a poem or a beginning for a poem or even a commission for a poem. That I have written the odd commissioned poem, but that's normally not how it happens for me. Normally I am doing something else, or I'm walking along or something. And a line or a phrase will get hold of me, like the last line of Happiness, It's No Potato You Can Grow, which I think is half borrowed from Charlotte Bronte's Villette, I think. I can't quite remember, but I think it's half borrowed from there.
So did you work backwards from that?
I guess. And then I was thinking, I don't think I came up with the title initially. Everybody's head is full of all sorts of stuff, isn't it? And my head is full of people, things I've read, movies I've seen, music I'm listening to, places. I've lived in a number of places around the world. So there's a whole junk shop inside, and suddenly, or for some reason, a bit of this kind of presents itself. So I'm mad about this. Has got these little references to some of my favourite movies in this poem. So my absolutely favourite movie in the world is Les Enfants du Paradis, which is a French term for the gods in the theatre.
Mm-hmm.
And the children of paradise, paradise being the gods, as it were. And it's this amazing film, released just after the end of the Second World War. The first French movie, certainly, perhaps one of the first movies to be released. And it has three main, four main male characters, all in love with Garance.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Who, at the end of the movie, dwindles into the crowd and disappears. And, of course, I'm a Casablanca kind of nut.
Rick, turning from the plane.
The Lisbon plane, the plane that would have taken him and the woman that he's in love with to freedom, but he's turning from it because he's going to continue the fight. Caine, High Noon, one of my favourite. I have a weakness for Westerns. There's even a poem in here called Weakness for Westerns.
No.
So this is High Noon, played by Gary Cooper. And at the end of the movie, where he's felt honour-bound to come back and face enemies from the past and basically save the town. But the town doesn't appreciate him. And there's a wonderful moment at the end of the film where he takes off the star and throws it on the ground. So probably those are pretty familiar to most listeners, but Mosby maybe not quite so familiar.
No, tell me about Mosby.
This is a private eye movie called Night Moves, which has Gene Hackman in the lead role, and it's a fantastic movie. Doesn't get as much notice or airplay as it should. And he's, at the end of the movie, he's on a boat which is called Point of View, which is a little bit of a kind of clue to the viewer that you should have been, you should have been thinking about Point of View as you were watching. It's quite a twisty movie, but wonderful.
So happiness, it is an elusive thing, isn't it? But we catch it at different moments, and it changes as you age too.
And we hang on to the hope of it, and the possibility of it. But we probably all know people for whom it really didn't happen.
Mm. Mm.
So there are people who seem always to have been happy, lovely, and to have spread happiness around them. So those they knew know. Mm. As we were saying earlier in conversation, you feel better after seeing that person.
Mm-hmm.
So you feel happier. So they're not just got it themselves. They're able to kind of give it around, a lovely quality. But equally, there are people who seem inoculated against happiness, perhaps by childhood, perhaps by, other early experience. And so no matter what happens or who they meet or what situation they may be in, it ain't going to happen.
No, happiness does not eventuate. This is, even though it's a sad book for you, Harry, because at our age we are saying goodbye, losing friends, loved ones, our lives are changing, but there's a lot of happiness in these pages. You've captured moments.
Oh, well, that's good. I'm glad you think that.
I do.
That's nice.
From my perspective.
Yeah, that's good. It's true that my mother had relatively recently died at the age of 92. Shortly before I started writing these poems that are in this book, And my lovely wife, Belinda, died almost exactly 2 years ago, but none of the poems here cover the period after that. So it's
leading kind up of, to
yeah,
it.
Yeah, they were all written, as it were, in the aftermath of my mother dying and with the knowledge that Belinda was going to die, she had stage 4 cancer. Miraculously, she managed to survive for five nearly five years on treatment. Very precious years, of course. But we both knew that, you know, she wasn't going to.
No.
She wasn't going to make very old bones. So you know, some of my favourite poems are poems by other people are sad poems, melancholy ones, but often they're witty. I love witty poems. So the combination of wit and melancholy is a very attractive one to me. And I hope that maybe some of these poems might have a bit of that about them.
Oh, some wonderful word plays. There's some wonderful descriptive phrases in here. And I think, you know, without sounding trite, you have a really smart, clever, witty way of ending a lot of them. So there is a wry smile at the end of what might be a melancholy. You might have started off in a state of melancholy, but you've ended with a twist there that...
I mean, one of the things that happened, you know, during the time that I was writing these poems was that I came up with a kind of imaginary New Zealand poet. I don't quite know where she came from. Stella, she's called, and there's a sequence of poems about her. And I've no idea where she came from, except that had I been a girl, I would have been called Stella. So I've always liked the name Stella and have occasionally asked friends if they thought I'd be happier if I'd been Stella. And all my female friends say, no, you wouldn't, which I, you know, I appreciate.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Male friends not so interested in the question of whether I might have been Stella. But anyway, Stella. So Stella kind of appeared sometime around 2020, I suppose, and I wrote an original poem about her, sort of imagining her living in Belinda's and my house at an earlier point. Her father was German, called Johnny, but really Johann, and he'd been interned on Soames Island. So Stella would spend a certain amount of time, which you could do from our car pad, staring across at Soames Island. Obviously, he wasn't there any longer, but thinking about him there. And I imagined a neighbour telling people who turned up to find Stella's house, telling them, you know, it was pretty much as it had been when she lived there, but you shouldn't go down because the current occupants were not very friendly. And she'd published one book of poems, because she's half German, called Unheimlich, which means uncanny. Longman Paul, who were a real publisher, of course.
I know, yeah.
Who my godmother worked for a time back in the 1950s.
My mother was a friend of Janet Paul's.
Is that right?
Oh, when they were in Hamilton.
Right. Yes.
So New Zealand has all these very close links.
Has all these kind of strange links, doesn't it? Yes.
It does.
My mother was Cornish, but like Stella's mother, as it turns out. But she was fond of German as a language. She spoke good French and German. And German's always appealed to me as a language, and not, of course, all of the German culture, of course not. But you know, some of my favourite writers are German. So this all kind of... So she just kind of appeared, and I found myself writing other poems, some supposedly by her and some about what happened to her. Mm-hmm. She had a female partner, by the way.
Yes.
Called Lisa.
Who she sent off with a knife. I mean, wielded a knife to get rid of her.
They had a big bust-up.
Yes.
Because Lisa was very rude about Stella's father.
That's right.
And so she had to go. Anyway, so poem, I mean, I think the thing is that poems come out of all sorts of strange places. And... sometimes you can think at least that you know the trail that takes you back there, but sometimes you just don't at all. And really, in the case of Stella, I don't know. She just appeared, but I was very grateful that she did. And I became very, for a time, about 9 months or so, very preoccupied with her.
Harry, I think we should finish with her, and I can thoroughly recommend with the Stella poems. They are Stella in a lot of ways.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice you say that.
But you're going to finish for us with...
Okay, so this is a poem for Belinda, and it's the last poem that I showed to her, so she did get to read it. And it's called The Chemical Life, and it, in effect, describes a very characteristic day in the last few months of her life and our life together. The Chemical Life for Belinda. Each day we practice a kind of magic, trying to make today resemble yesterday. I wake up when the light starts to spill across our bed, check on you. Your mouth is usually half open. Your chest rises and falls, rises and falls. I creep out, make coffee, do Wordle and the puzzles, check on you. Your chest rises and falls. Rises and falls. I have a shower, put on a small variety of the same clothes, jeans, Pink Floyd t-shirt, blue or black jersey. At some point, you appear in the kitchen, looking a little dazed, swallow pills with orange juice, begin another day of the chemical life. Sometimes you have a boiled egg or tomatoes on toast before you lie down again. And I join you and read another chapter of The Small House at Allington. And so the hours slowly unwind. Perhaps a friend visits, or a nurse from the hospice, and you summon a spurt of conversation. At some point, after further lie-downs and checks, you climb up the steps with a stick, count the bees among the lemon trees and the white roses, pause at the top to stare at Soames Island, where enemy aliens were interned in both world wars, before slowly, carefully, you descend. Later, courtesy of friends, there's a meal which you pick at during the news. An episode of Seinfeld, then some cereal. Next, your shower, more pills, another chapter. Moonlight throws stripes across the bed.
Bonfires on the Ice by Harry Ricketts is published by Te Herenga Waka Press. And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.